I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Sans Pants Radio, Australia's happiest podcast network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George DeMorelis. This is the show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show, we have a presenter on TV. You might remember him from Good News Week back in the day. He's done radio, he's done stand-up. You've brought out three books at this point, as well as several co-authored ones. Mikey Robbins, how are you doing?
Well, mate, basically, you describe me as the whore of Babylon. I will go anywhere there's a paycheck. Yeah, mate, I'm good. I'm really good. Nice to talk to you, George.
Nice to talk to you.
You do a bit of stand-up too, don't you?
Yeah.
Have we ever done a gig?
No, we haven't. Nah. No, unfortunately, I think you might be at a different echelon to where I'm at. So, yeah.
No, mate, I'll go to the opening of a head wound. You know, I'm easy.
Well, yeah, it's like the whore of Babylon was an early warning.
Yeah, it's like whatever a function says, Mikey Robbins, I might as well say underneath Tom Gleason was busy.
Mate, if that's who you're backing up to, that's not so bad. You're doing all right.
Yeah, not too bad.
Were you doing stand-up forever, or was that like a...
No.
Yeah.
I got into the business as a writer, as a sketch writer. Mm-hmm. Well, for the Cabaret Group, long story short, I was a sketch writer. I was writing sketches for Triple J, and then I lied to management and told them how I knew how to operate a panel, and they always took the people to do Midnight to Dawns. I still hold the record for taking the station off air 16 times in my first shift. Yeah, I was. Ian Rogerson is a fantastic broadcaster. Gave me a 10-minute lesson on how to operate a panel, and I stuffed it up. And I just drifted into presenting, and then sort of from that radio and TV. And then a couple of years ago, when I was turning 50, my wife described it as my midlife crisis. So I went, I really should do some stand up because I've never done it. And yay!
Welcome.
It's like, wow, I missed all that time standing backstage with other comics, watching the other person on stage going, oh no, they're doing really well. Oh shit.
Yeah, it's going to go. Yeah, the terror of seeing, it's always a mixed bag. You're sitting backstage and sometimes like, yeah, the terrifying thing of when the crowd hates everyone and you're like, oh no, but there's a certain freedom in that as well, because you're like, it doesn't matter. Screw these guys. Like,
Yeah.
Like the other side is when someone's killing so hard and you got to go on next and you're like, oh God, this is, yeah, if the MC doesn't calm them down, this is going to be so annoying to deal with.
And then there's the other rule, which is never follow Akmal, because the man has no internal. I mean, he's one of the funniest guys in Australia, but you know, Akmal thinks an hour is 15 minutes.
Yeah, look, I got to say, you established personalities. You're not good on the timepiece ever. You've earned it.
Oh mate, I'm the laziest comic in the world. Seriously, I will get off once I get my first decent laugh. Fuck that, I'm gone.
Okay. Leave on a high. I'm out, guys.
I got a round. Thanks. See ya.
Sometimes you don't even say a joke. You just come on, they cheer, and you're like, I am good. All right.
That's enough for me. I am that shallow, George. I am that shallow.
That is, look, I comedian, I can understand. I can vibe with that. Just want everyone to like me. If they've shown they like me, I am out before they don't like me, because they will eventually if this goes too long.
Yeah. It's just, you know, listen to a mate of mine, Steve Abbott, who had a character called the Sandman, who once said the line, laughter is the hug that only strangers can give.
That's kind of poetic, actually. Yeah. That's really nice.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Yeah.
So, yeah, because you went from panel shows. So you were used to presenting in front of people. You've done that forever. But it was just the stand-up itself, which you felt the need to.
Yeah.
Because it was getting bigger. I'm guessing you're getting asked all the time to give it a go as well?
Well, it was a combination of two things. I mean, philosophically, it's like, you know, I'd done the Newsweek and the panel shows, and a lot of the people on, and a lot of my friends were stand-up. And, you know, I'd written sketches, I'd done radio, and I thought that, you know, stand-up is sort of like the core of what I'd been making a living out of for years. So I thought, I really should do this. And also, too, you know, because of having a profile, I get a lot of corporate work, and if you can do a stand-up routine, you can charge a lot more. I'm sorry
I
to
love
say,
the
but
honesty.
Yeah. It's like, you know what, if I can get a tight 20 without too much swearing in it, I can make some money.
That's brilliant. That is brilliant. You start with the philosophical thing. You're like, oh, you know, and it's the time for telling truths and use my profile. But also the sweet cold hard cash, baby. That's
oh, yeah, daddy needs a new pair of jeans.
That's fair enough. I haven't seen so like when you approach it, like actually what, so with the writing, because this you're the first person I've had on who's actually probably done that many varied things. Do you approach them all in different ways, like from the writing for the sketch or for the stand-up or the books? Like
it's weird. Sketch writing is how I started. I haven't done that in, I'd say, 25 years. Sketch writing is like, it's that thing where you tend to write it in real time. Like, as long as the sketch, a bit longer than the sketch takes. Writing the book, it's, I've written two solo books on my own now, I'm halfway through my third. And I found the only way to approach it was like, well, this is my job. Like, I'm in my home office at the moment, which is next to my lounge room. But when I go to write, I have to have, this sounds really tragic. You know, people say, have you prepared to write? Well, I have to have a shower and put a collared shirt on. that way I feel like I'm going to work.
That is some old school, school version of what work is. I love that.
Yeah, it's like, no, I can't sit there, you know, in the tracky decks. I have to put a pair of jeans and a shirt on because that way I feel like I'm working. It's, I know, it's silly, but, you know.
No, that's it.
Was it Victor Hugo that used to write only wearing a smock because he found anything? But a lot of people think that Victor Hugo wrote The Nude, but no, he just used to wear a smock because he wanted a lack of distraction. I've moved beyond the smock.
Yeah.
I'm trying harder than Victor Hugo.
I love that for Victor Hugo, that being naked was a distraction. What was he getting distracted by, I wonder? Same thing with Well, that's because so speaking of Victoria, so that's actually this conversation is going to jump around a lot, but that relates to the book you're bringing out. This was brought out just recently, The Reprehensible, about historical figures.
Polite histories of bad behavior.
Yeah, so that's like, so basically it's a little take of like bits of random bits of famous people from history who maybe didn't act so great.
Well, yeah, but, you know, it's everything from Cleopatra's dildos to the guy who rigged the 1978 soapbox derby so his nephew could win. It's just scoundrels through history. The fact that C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Narnia books, which we all read as a kid, also got thrown out of a party at Oxford for offering other students 5 shillings if he could take them into the spare room and spank them. Yeah, talking about your 50 Shades of Narnia.
It's like he was like a hardcore Christian, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, actually, that's the thing that's interesting. He was because the Narnia books are all Christian allegorical tales. There's a cult in America. Oh, now, there's a phrase you hardly use these days. There's a cult in America that worships him. There's actually a stained glass window on
him. No, there's not. But yet, are you serious?
Dude, go online and check it out. And but this is the same guy who used to write letters to a mate of his who was a poet, describing how he'd like to take the guy's sister over his knee and spank her with a hairbrush.
You're probably not the first religious figure who said that, to be honest.
No. Actually, I also write a bit about popes too, including one pope who I love, the trial of Formosus. Formosus was a pope, and the bloke who followed him hated the previous pope so much that he dug him up and put his corpse on trial for blasphemy.
You got to love that. That's you would have had a rousing defense, I'm sure.
They actually had a defense cardinal who actually used to kneel behind him and whisper answers. Now, you know, the Pope would go, "Why did you do these things?" And then his defense cardinal would go, "Because I am evil." And so then after the trial, they actually they executed the dead body.
Oh, my God. That's fantastic.
It's like, you know, the popes are good for a couple of stories. Like the Borgias, they had a thing called the Feast of the Chestnuts. which was basically, whenever you put cardinals and prostitutes in the same room, it's going to end up pretty wild.
Yeah, there's going to be more sins by the end, not less.
Actually, that was one of the funniest things about promoting the last book, because I do like a lot of ABC radio, and I go, I can't really, if I tell that story, you'll be off air. And there was one journalist was really nice, and she kept wanting me to tell the Mozart story, and I said, I cannot tell the Mozart story. In fact, I'll just say that the chapter about Mozart is called Two Pianos, One Cup.
Oh.
Okay. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
he may have been one of the greatest geniuses in Western music, but he had two problems.
Wow. Okay. That is that's a lot. That's a lot there, Mikey.
he actually wrote a song about it called "Lick My Ass Nice and Clean."
You got to love how people think smut is like a new thing, and it's just like no.
But it's one of the things I wrote about in the book is there's a sentence. And I actually say in the book, I thought I'd never write this sentence. The ancient Greeks were incredibly comfortable with dildos. They've actually found pottery from the golden age of Hellenic culture. And everything that you might have seen on a porn site, Greeks are doing it. They invented the strap-on, the double-ended. It's one of the things I found when I was researching the book is whatever you think, you know, is new and kinky, it's been around for years.
Well, look, as a Greek background Australian, I do feel a bit of pride in all that. So,
they used to call dildos strikers, so God knows what they were doing with them.
That's fine. Yeah, no, so it's true. I actually recently saw some letters James Joyce used to write to his partner. It's just the filthiest thing I've ever read in my entire life.
Because the guy was actually, I actually write about it, the guy was turned on by flatulence.
Yeah, that's what it is.
But also, too, I love the fact that he's well, they were sort of married. Her name was Nora Barnacle, which is just one of the best names. It's like a character from one of his books. You know, what are you going to do this afternoon? Oh, Nora Barnacle.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. It's great to kind of point that out as well, because people can get a bit too caught up about the current times of that stuff.
Did
you write it from that point of view? Like, you're like, oh, let's have a look at that, or was it something that was in the back of your head you wanted to talk about, or why was that?
It was my first book, Seven Deadly Sins of One Very Naughty Fruit, was about bizarre food history stories, as seen through the prism of the seven deadly sins. And I got to the end of it after researching it for about a year, and went, there's a whole bunch of stories left over that aren't really food related. And I just like that. Paddling around in the shallow end of the history pool.
Yeah,
and the fact that Ulysses S. Grant was a great general, a pretty average president. Also, too, he was a never nude.
No way.
Yeah, Ulysses S. Grant, even though he had four kids, bragged that not even his wife had ever seen him naked.
I love that gets recorded in history. That is bizarre.
Yeah. Even during the Civil War, he wouldn't shower with the other guys. Yeah, enough of the book. But yeah, that's pretty much what I do. I basically look at all your heroes and literature and military and philosophy, and I make fun of them.
Yeah, I mean that seems like just you doing what you're doing on Good News Week, but just from a historical perspective, so I can totally understand.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, someone said to me the other day, said, "I bet you wish Good News Week was on." And I said, "Well, you know, quite frankly, I think we're living in a post-satirical world." You wake up every morning and you put CNN on and go, seriously? Is this a skit?
It's gotten pretty wild, hasn't it? You're like, yeah. It's almost like the jokes, because it's almost self-satire, so it's like, it's not even funny anymore. You're like, no. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. Imagine they just decide to cage children one day, and it's like, oh, that joke's sad now.
And what if, you know, what if the president's lead attorney is the ex-mayor of New York, but his hair dye runs? And seriously, he has a press conference from a car park out the front of a landscape building next to a dildo shop. Oh, dildos again.
Yeah. The Greeks strike again.
Yeah.
That would be – I have heard that from a few people. It's just become a bit too ridiculous now. And I feel like almost more – yeah, I don't know. More – it's sad. It's like, as in, everyone's feeling the effects of it all more a bit now. So it's almost harder to joke about it in a way.
You know, I was doing an interview the other day, and someone said, you know, could you describe 2020 in one word? And I went, It's been fucking exhausting.
Two words, but I think it's appropriate.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's... well, look, I think... Luckily, it's all fixed now, right? We're all good.
Hot! Yeah, no, all next year's going to be a food. Next year, 2021's going to be a fucking food. Yeah,
we've fixed everything. We've turned back the clock to about like 3 years before 2016, so... I'm pretty sure we're coasting now. Everyone can relax. So what do you do with your stand-up then? Do you actually talk about modern stuff or is it...
It's weird. I mostly just sort of tell personal stories, but I haven't been on a stage. I did a gig in Barrel in March and then came home and I watched every booking for the next 12 months go away in 72 hours. And, you know, I know it sounds wanky, but, you know, I've traveled a lot. For work, it's like being a traveling salesman. You know the drill. You travel, and I was looking for an old pair of thongs the other day, and I found my overnight bag covered in dust. So, but fortunately, I had the reprehensible to finish off, and then I had the new book, so I've been busy. But apart from going in to record a few podcasts, I haven't worked outside of the house since March.
All right. Now that's going to feel a bit closed in. Because where are you based? You're in Newcastle, or is that?
No, I'm in Sydney. No, I'm from Newcastle, but I'm in Sydney.
All right. Yeah. Well, look, it's a year for self reflection and review and seeing how things going. I feel like.
Right. Seriously, the biggest decision you have to make of the day is like, should I put track pants on or boxer shorts?
Or in your case, a collared shirt and jeans.
Yeah, if I'm lying, but I'm just lying on the couch. There's been a lot of lying on the couch.
Right. That again, appropriate year for it. Yeah. And I think it's good. I don't know. I don't know if you're planning to get back out there, but it is interesting going back into comedy now. Because in Melbourne, we had like obviously the 6 month stint, and everyone.
Yeah.
It is just like it's the common thread. So everyone's united, and like it just feels like there's a lot of. There's a tense-up energy in the rooms, which is, even from the crowd's point of view, like, everyone is just free. It's got this wild thing to it, which is really cool, actually, to be seeing and be a part of. Like,
I actually said to my agent, I said, next year I might just go out and do a bit of stuff just for the fun of it, just because, because there's a whole bunch of stuff I did, which I'm going to need some new gear. I have to sit down and write some new shit. Okay, yeah, that's generally taken care of.
That's all right. That's what do you put on for the writing the comedy? A clown costume or something?
That's sad, but you know, actually, here's something embarrassing about me that I don't often talk about. I actually paid my way through uni doing kids' parties as a clown.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, you can read about it in my upcoming memoir, Mummy the Clown Said Fuck.
Surely you've learned that. Although the kids would love that. It's just the parents who would get upset.
Basically, I used to get $40 into an hour's kids' party. And you do a little show, but quite frankly, a clown is just another human being that children can kick in the anus. So you turn up, you get kicked, you do a little routine, you eat some chocolate crackles, and then you had beer money for the rest of the week.
So were you doing that before you were doing any sort of like, was that like your introduction to entertaining almost?
No, when I was at uni, I did legitimate theatre.
Ah.
And then me and a couple other guys decided, some girls just to do weird stuff in the bar. Just skits and bits of stand-up. But we had one good thing. One of the guys could play bagpipes. And that will shut a room up like nobody's business. If you enter behind someone playing bagpipes, right now, if I could have anything written into my rider as a performer, enter with bagpipes.
That is some interesting insights right there. That's true. Right. Yeah. It's just going to make, you can't talk over it. It is just overwhelming.
Suddenly you're in a crowd of bars like, fuck, bagpipes. There you go.
What do you know? That's a, I feel like that is information that I might be able to use someday. So thank you for that.
Yes. Yeah, no worries.
It's actually, especially like a rowdy pub where it's like everyone's crashing those kind of nights, that could be hugely useful.
Mm.
Nice. Thanks, Mikey.
See, I was saying, what's the definition of a gentleman? A man who knows how to play the bagpipes but doesn't.
I like that. That's a good one.
should we talk books?
Yes, we can talk books. Yes, we can. So your choice of book you've gone with for today is?
Catch 22, because I'm a middle-aged white guy. And every middle-aged white guy, the first big book they probably read was Catch 22. I just turned 59. That'll make you feel old. That makes me feel old. And I, in fact, I was just, before I chatted to you, I thought I'd better do a little bit of research, because by the time I read Catch-22 when I was a teenager, it was already a classic. So I assume it must have been written in, actually the book is only 1 month older than I am. It came out in November 1961. I was born in December. I'm not saying the two events are related, but there you go. So, but it's one of those books that just quickly became such a classic. And as a teenager, and it formed a lot of my sort of, you know, opinions on life and stuff.
Right. So as a teenager, it formed your opinions. How so?
Yeah, well, it is that sort of anti-authoritarian, you know, sort of fuck you attitude about it, which I really like.
Mm. And it was like something you came to. Did you just reflected how you were feeling at the time anyway?
Yeah, but it's like, you know, when you're 14, 15, you're starting to sort of get a world view of politics, and, you know, and I was, so we're talking the mid-70s, so sort of that post-Vietnam War thing, and, you know, and Whitlam, and so, you know, I was a bit lefty as a teenager. And that book sort of fitted into, you know, that anti, you know, the powers that be are crazy. And it's our job to try and survive them.
Yeah, because it's almost like a nihilist in a certain way.
Yeah.
Take of it, though, so I guess.
But one of my favorite things, too, is because, you know, a lot of people know it was Joseph Hell's first book. He wrote a few books afterwards. And he quite often got asked in interviews, you know, why haven't you written a book as good as Catch-22? And his answer was, who has?
That is a great quip.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. And also, too, it was turned into a fairly good movie and, in fact, a really good TV series.
Is that with George Clooney?
Yeah. Anything with George Clooney is easy to get my wife to watch.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, was it the comedy as well that you liked, or was it?
It's one of those few books that will actually make you laugh out loud without being. I mean, the other one I remember from around about the same time was a book called 1066 and all that, which was a parody of English history. And that made me laugh out loud. Because it's an unusual thing to laugh out loud reading a book. It's a wonderful feeling. It's, you know, something I would like to think occasionally people get a right chuckle out of my writing. So it's weird because, as you know, there's a certain amount of, not just the joke, but timing when you're on stage. And Heller gets that timing so damn right on the page, which is a really difficult thing to do. And yeah, it took him 8 years to write the first book.
Right.
Yeah. I'm just saying that out loud in case my publisher is listening to this, and I will make my May deadline. I promise.
I love that's the way you communicate with him now. That's where the relationship's
at. Yeah, it's best that way.
I agree. Like, I just think, and with his writing especially, I thought it was very much like, it was a silliness to it. So, like, as in, it could turn sometimes where it's like from start of a sentence to the end, it just like goes in a completely different direction. You're like, this is just, it just would hit you with that unexpectedness.
And the fact that the structure of the book is not linear, but it makes sense. I remember I ended up studying at year 12 and I had to do Milo's thing about how he gets eggs. And I had to break down that whole chapter and show how it worked on a blackboard with chalk. And it was exhausting.
I love how many words you just said that were blackboard and chalk. That is really getting getting a picture of the times of life.
Yeah. No, yes, I actually grew up in Victorian England.
There's very little difference you could have.
I am so old. I was the last year that went through where you could get a cane.
Oh, wow. Really?
In a public school. Yeah.
Did you ever get a cane?
Yeah. But not a lot. You know, mind you, I, if you had a choice between staying after school or getting, you know, two of the best or four of the best, you take the cane.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I didn't mind the cane. It was the, you know, it was getting into the leather outfit first that used to seem a bit weird.
I don't know. A different time then, you know. That's their outfits.
A different time.
Well, actually, that's funny because, like, do you reckon that feeds into a sentiment at your, like you're saying, everyone from your age group was like, loves Catch-22. Do you think something like that would feed into it? Like the fact that you had such a physical manifestation of, I guess.
Well, I think a lot of it was my father fought in the Korean War, and a lot of guys I went to school with had grandparents who fought in the Second World War. And, you know, as a teenager, we'd just gotten out of the Vietnam War. So there was a strong sort of sense of a military history. Like someone pointed out to me the other day that, you know, when we were kids at school, all our principals were all men, and they all would have served in the military, which is why we had to march everywhere. I mean, just think about it now. Why the hell would you make a bunch of eight-year-olds march into assembly?
But they actually, like, lined you up in rows and...
Oh, yeah. Assembly was marching, and you had to stand at ease, and, you know, it was... Actually, it's now that I think back on it, it's really fucking creepy.
at the same time, and there's going to be... But it would be kind of adorable as well, seeing a bunch of eight-year-olds...
Yeah.
But yeah, that is strange, though. And that's a good point. As in, like,
so school was actually quite militaristic, and so a book like that sort of fed into that anti-authoritarian thing. And I was thinking about, you know, when you said you wanted to do this, I was trying to think about this, that, and that. And I thought, well, I'll say catch 22, and I'll probably get an email back saying you're the 50th guy who said catch 22.
No, you're the first, actually, so there you go. But you're also the first 59-year-old white male, so.
Yeah, there's a couple of us left.
Yeah, they've taken down the rest, haven't they? The Twitter auntie.
Well, it's funny, I'm sick and tired of, and this is just off on a tangent, I'm sick and tired of guys my age, old white guys doing the, oh, it's so hard to be funny these days. I'm like, fuck off. Mm. No, it's not. Just don't be a dick.
That's I think that sums it up as concise as you can.
It's like, yeah, there's nothing wrong. You can still be offensive and not be a misogynist, homophobic turd.
What? But it's so much easier.
What? Yeah. So it's like, oh, I wish I could do that. No, don't do that.
Yeah.
Here's the question. If you think it might be racist, it's racist.
Mm. And, like, what is the joke? Like, that's, for me, it's always that. It's like, if the joke is just that it's racist, it's like, that's
not the joke.
And again, it's almost like, that's, for me, it's almost even separate to the very legitimate concerns about, like, upsetting people because it's just of that stuff. So it's just lazy. It's just lazy. Like, yeah, it's been done. We'd had the
80s. I saw quite a bit of it, and it wasn't pretty.
I could imagine, actually, back then, everyone just agree. It's almost just everyone laughing in angry agreement about some sort of slurs and stuff. They're like, ha ha ha,
it was funny because I didn't perform in the 80s, but I used to go to comedy clubs, and there's a lot of angry, angry guys with poor toilet training.
They do. It could go hand in hand, those things as well, yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't get too strict or not strict enough principle.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm actually interested in this. You've actually made me think about this a bit more, though, in terms of what you were saying about like the militaristic principle and stuff. Because you were 61, so you were going to school then. So it's interesting because I just recently read this book called "Ill Fares the Land" by Tony Judd.
Oh, yeah.
it's kind of a historical looking at like how perceptions changed, especially after World War II, and how that impacted things and how people like respected the state a lot more. Just after World War II, but then because the older generation respected it so much, the new kids that came up were almost anti anything to do with community or the state because they saw it as such a controlling thing because they hadn't experienced two world wars and a depression to realize actually we do need to keep them involved a little bit. But it seems like you almost came in after that a little bit. Because when you're saying the anti-authoritarian thing, because I feel like the state is needed. You're not like one of these people that's like small governments, like da-da-da, but you're kind of at the same time as don't tell me what to do. I don't know, that contrast there.
But then again, you look at what 2020's been, and quite frankly, you do realize that we need good governance. I mean, you're saying you're coming from Melbourne, and the way, apart from a few nut jobs, Melbourne just went, you know what? The experts are telling me this. I'm going to do this, and we'll get through it. It's like, there is something to be said for the collective mindset.
Yeah, at least like, you don't have to do it brutally, but you do it where you're honest and presenting everything, and then
the thing about Catch 22, it's not like just tear down the system. It's like, well, the system's a bit shit.
Yeah, it's flawed.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's flawed. It's flawed.
Yeah, and then it just shows, I mean, again, you mentioned it, the eggs buying scene in the book. Yeah. Now, you've got to be testing my memory because I've read it twice, but it was quite, and that's how I knew it was good, because the first time I read it, I was like, this is good. And then I read it again, like, 10 years later, and I'm like, this is still brilliant.
It's one of those books, I read it as a teenager, then I did it in year 12, and then I did it again later at uni, because I was doing American literature, and Moby Dick is really thick.
Yeah, it's solid. The most detailed whaling guide you didn't expect you'd read.
Yeah, I know, and it's like, the thing about Milo, it's interesting. Like, you look at Milo, might have been that character, and that whole thing of, you know, getting rich off other people's misfortune. I mean, it's as relevant now as it was almost 60 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, and the way he plays it almost, and this is why I think the book works so well, like the scene where it's set in such a neutral tone, some of the horrible things that happen, which make it somehow funnier. Like, he just bombs his own troops and kills all these people, and it's just, everyone's just like, because then it's not done.
Well, that happens.
Yeah, it's just this sense of almost no attachment to it in a way. Like, everyone's just kind of like, it just accepts it in the way it delivers it. That's, I think that makes it hit kind of hard because,
Well, that's because the writing itself is very matter of fact. He's not one for purple prose. Which is one of the things I really like. It's actually a very easy book to read. And I'm a deeply lazy man, so, you know. One of the mistakes I made when we first went into the lockdown, I announced on Twitter that I was going to finally sit down at my age after 25 attempts and read Ulysses. And I was going to tweet about what I'd read every day. And I did that for about a week. And after 7 days, my tweet was, you know what? The second season of Family Guy still holds up.
Look, I haven't. It's the greatest book ever read, but I don't know. It seems like
I've read the Dubliners. That'll do me.
Yeah, I've heard Dubliners probably a better, and the Portrait of a Young Man as well is actually very good for that.
Yeah. Oh, look, I kept diving in the Ulysses, and I was sitting there by my bedside, almost taunting me.
And like, it's a big taunt. It's a big. You can't
mind
miss it.
You though, with it. If you ever at a dinner party with someone, here's a hint. Someone starts talking about Ulysses. Learn something from page 450 and drop it in. And if their face on there goes blanking on, you're bullshitting too.
Look, it's a good strategy. I agree. I am definitely not the kind of person who says, like, Ulysses and what's the one that everyone talks about? The Infinite Jest. Have you read that?
No.
That's the other one everyone says.
Well, see, here's one of the problems too, and you're about to hit that age. Something happens to guys, they turn a certain age, and a lot more nonfiction starts turning up on their bookshelves.
Yeah.
I'm a big one for a historical biography. Probably my second favorite book of all time is Peter Ackroyd's biography of Sir Thomas More, which is a fantastic read.
Really? Okay. That's a...
Yeah, it's a really good book. Really good book. Oh, I think I pronounced his name wrong. Acord, I always get it wrong, but it's a really good read.
That's interesting because I literally just finished Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel.
Ah! Well, then go on and read Thomas More because Wolf Hall's a really good historical, you know, sex and stories, you know, it's good. Yeah. But the biography of Thomas More is really good. Have you seen the TV series of Wolf Hall?
No, I haven't. That's
it's really good.
All right. Okay, I get you. Well, because the funny thing for me, because I've just, it's a very rough, in fact, like, I don't want to ruin it by looking at the history of what actually happened. So I don't know what happens with these characters in a way, like, because that whole part of history, I know that obviously Henry VIII is renowned for all the beheadings of his wives. But apart from that, I don't know much else. So I'm like actually interested to keep reading it and find out, even though it's happened.
Actually, I do a small chapter, a small story on Henry VIII in my book Reprehensible, because apart from the whole, you know, pretty bad husband, split up the church, glutton, one of the things too was he was an absolutely mad gambler, but not very good at it. He actually, where St. Paul's Cathedral is, there was a cathedral there, and had been pretty much since Norman times. He lost the bells from that cathedral over one throw of the dice. And he used to enter these card games, tournaments. I mean, it'd be like, you know, Queen Elizabeth going on Joker Poker.
But worse, because she can actually, like, lose parts of the state.
Look, I was just thinking, you know, you've been bluffing all, you know, he takes off the tiara going, you've been bluffing all night. I'm going all in.
Okay, so just to add, it's really, he was the whole package, wasn't he, old Henry VIII?
Yeah, and he stunk too. Mind you, they all stunk in those days.
Yeah, that's it. I've heard about that, the great London stink and all that sort of thing.
We are talking about a man who had four beers before breakfast.
That's going to have damage after a while. But the reason I found that so interesting was because, like, I always, when I first heard of Thomas More, I'd heard of this golden.
That's interesting, yeah. But in Wolf Hall, in the Acquard book, it's quite measured. Because there's that thing, too, that, you know, he was obviously a very intelligent man, but a rabid Catholic.
Yeah, fundamentalist. Like.
And didn't really blush at burning people.
I think that's what makes it, because I actually had another guest on quite a while ago now, and he was talking about A Man for All Seasons, the play, which he loved, and because of its representation of Thomas More as like a man of such good morals that he refuses, like he's such a good man in a way, but then it's like, oh, now you've reframed that to be, I don't know, this is a religious fundamentalist.
And he actually was a guy who wore a hair shirt. He did wear a hair shirt underneath his clothes just to make himself uncomfortable. And probably also too, was a little bit too fond of self-flagellation.
Yeah, like yeah, just a little bit there. Like that's true, yeah. Yeah, no, so I knew you've got all the... Because actually, I don't think what I saw when I was looking you up, you're also 2005 winner of Australia's Brainiest Comedian, right?
Yeah, yay. That was fun, actually. I was lucky because there was a history section in the middle. And I almost did like a Steve Bradbury because, who else was on? There was, Bob Down and Red Simons. And they were so intent on taking each other out that I sort of slid through the middle and won. And then the next year I did, Comedy Great Temptation, and I won that as well, which is cool. But the really good thing about that is you have no idea that you're playing for a home viewer and because the show's pre-recorded. And I won two Volvos, a trip overseas, and fucking for cash. And I got this lovely letter from the woman who was the home viewer, and they were two self-funded retired teachers from rural Victoria. And their old Volvo was just about to pack it in, and I won them two new ones.
Oh, it's beautiful.
So I did something nice.
Yeah, that adds to it. To go back to the book with the Catch-22 stuff, I do find, and it's interesting because you say this, because you do seem to be, even though you're in comedy and you're hilarious, you do obviously take in all these more intense things in history, and you've got quite a serious bent as well, obviously from...
All comedians are just people that absorb information and then you know. Yeah, when you talk about doing Australia's brainiest comedian, you find this when you're, you know, when you're backstage and you're talking to comics. They're all, a lot of them are history nerds. A lot of them read a lot of stuff. And so, you know, so, yeah. And then, you know, you take that and you put a fart joke on top and that pays the rent.
Yeah, just had a couple of quips to keep it interesting as you go along. And
yeah.
Well, yeah. That's actually what I was, yeah, because.
Anyone who gets up there, I mean, maybe I'm just getting nicer in my old age, but anyone who gets up there and has a crack has my respect.
Mm. No, I definitely agree. Anyone who can give that a go. Yeah, because it is. Look, you're going to get torn apart by the audience enough. I think you don't need to sit there and do it for them. Yeah.
Well, it's one of those things that, you know, when I've done more interviews than I've had green chicken curries. And they say, you know, is it bitchy? And they go, no, comics are actually pretty nice people, pretty supportive.
Really?
Because you're right. You know, it's a weird enough gig as it is. You might as well just try and get along with everyone.
I mean.
But yeah, we've all got someone we hope to.
I was going to say
this. I'm not going to say any names.
Ah, come on. Why not?
No. But we've all got a list.
A list now. But this is growing exponentially.
It's a short list. Come on.
I was about to say, with your bitchy comment, there's probably a lot of comedian WhatsApp groups that might have.
Yeah.
Prove like the opposite of that.
I social media scares me. I tweet occasionally.
That's as far as you'll go.
Yeah. Oh no, I don't do anything else. And quite frankly, yeah, someone said you do the Facebook. I mean, look, if I knew you at school and I wanted to see you, I'd call you.
Yeah, and it's weird for you because you guys would have had like, yeah, you'd be reconnecting almost like, we're good. I've changed enough. I think I'm okay.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I had a school reunion last year and I was like, there's no mouse. I was like, do I really want to spend 3 hours in a car? No.
It's not worth it. Just see a bunch of people you haven't talked to in 40 years, 30 years, whatever.
Yeah.
That's fair enough.
And basically, it's all like, you know, who's turned grey and who's gotten fat? And I was ahead of them. I turned grey early and I was fat at school. So, problem solved.
Yeah, that's it. They can see you on plenty of things anyway. Okay, because the reason I'm kind of interested in that is because I'm wondering if you seem to be mostly comedy is what you've done throughout all the time. Have you ever touched on trying to do anything more serious? You've had some documentaries, it seems, but is it like, have you ever gone into more serious?
At the moment, I'm working on a podcast series with a guy called Paul Wilson, who's a proper academic historian. And, the last two books, I mean, I think they're funny, but they're mostly just storytelling. It's something I came to, when I was writing the first book, particularly in the second one, is if there's a gag there, I'll go. But the most important is getting a story across and finding something interesting in the story. And so we've just done these podcasts and, I think we found some good stories. We found some really good, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. The assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was a fuck up from woe to go. One of my favorite stories is one of the assassination squad threw a bomb at the Archduke's car. It missed. He then took a suicide pill. It didn't work. So running away from the troops who were trying to capture him, he leapt off the bridge and threw himself into the river to drown. But Sarajevo was in drought at the time. He landed in mud and broke his ankles.
It's a comedy of errors, but...
Yeah, so I've been enjoying that. So it's not really going for the gag, but it is finding a weird ass story.
Yeah.
You know, the book I'm working on at the moment is called Idiots, Follies and Misadventures. Dumb is our constant companion. And the idea is that it's amazing as a species, we didn't kill ourselves 3 million years ago, 100,000 years ago, 10,000, you know, it's like the amount of stupid, like we like to think of history as this grand march of progress, but we're pretty fucking dumb.
Yeah, it's much closer to a comedy of errors.
it's amazing how we ever got to the top of the food chain.
Look, just reproduce enough, I guess. that's the same. But no, okay. So you've had that because Because, yeah, with your comedy and all that stuff. So you're saying now you do more personal stories, but even then obviously doing the more gag stuff when you're on stage and all your books and that is about, I guess, more joking stuff. Like even growing up, were you kind of like avoiding, I guess, it was the classic thing where you're kind of like, ah, my stuff's not that interesting, so I'm going to joke about this other stuff because that's more.
I don't know. On my mother's side, she came from a large Irish Catholic family. And the way you got attention was all my. Well, sort of weird, like half my aunts and uncles are really good storytellers and the others not so much. But the way you got attention was if you could tell a story. And when I was about 10, I don't know, I must have had a bit. My grandfather moved me from the kids' table to the grown-up table. And I remember going, and I dropped a gag about talking about some reason there was a controversy about breastfeeding. I was about 10. No, you know, talking about milk and carton or breast for babies. And I went, well, you know, one of them, the container's really cute, which is a boob joke.
Yeah.
From a 10-year-old.
That's pretty good.
And my grandfather laughed, but I'm thinking, oh, that's good. This is good. that's a nice feeling. This is good. I made the grown-ups laugh. Wow. You know, why don't I just sort of keep mitching around and maybe 20 years from now I'll get paid for this?
Yeah. That is an amazing origin story sort of story. I can't believe you even remember the gag, which shows you like.
Yeah, well, actually, I remember the gag because I stole it. It had been in a cartoon I'd seen the weekend before.
Oh, mate. That's what comedy is, though, right? You know?
But the first time I felt the love of grown-ups, I'd actually nicked the gag.
Yeah. Stolen it early, but it gave you the drug, right? So then you're like, okay, so I can go do that joking thing. So it wasn't as much like a defense mechanism or anything. It was more just like, this feels great.
Yeah, and also too, you know, as a fat kid, you know, you get picked on, so you can either throw a punch or you can get in first.
Oh, right, let's get in the gag, cut in a comment first.
Yeah, you know, and you know, so you become quite good at being, you know, well, basically, you know, A little short Rodney Dangerfield. Yeah, no respect.
So does that mean you then didn't get a punch, or does that mean at least then when you got the punch, you bloody earned it?
I managed to gag my way out of quite a few fights as a young man.
Yeah, I was going to say, because like back then, it's a different time. That stuff would have been a lot more prevalent as well.
I've been a kid several times.
Okay, that's the neutral way of putting that. But okay, because I always find it interesting what part of the appeal of the gag, I guess, from the funny people when it kind of hooked you and kind of brought you in, and why you choose the kind of comedy you do, and whether you fall into that.
Well, I you know, it's sort of weird. I don't know about you. I'm going to sit back and analyze it. It's always like, you know, you get to that space, and then it's the second thing that comes into your head. Hmm. The first thing that comes to your head is probably the second thing. And that's what I often think separates people who make a living out of comedy, is that they can edit their brain really quickly.
That's a good point. Like, as in when you're even, because now you're talking more almost from the improv side of things. So not when you're sitting there and writing and all that, but when you're sitting there and you're in a situation you can drop something, it's not the first thing that pops into your head sometimes. But
no.
Which it can be, but sometimes it's like, no, and then you get that second thought in and you go with that.
Yeah.
Having that live.
That the ability to riff is the ability to edit yourself as you go.
That's a good, I never thought about, like, which is true, because you're almost like, yep, done, and then go with that one on stage, right? Yeah, because you would have.
Yeah.
So did you start, So it's funny because you're talking about almost the exact opposite of writing in a lot of ways when you talk about that side of things.
Yeah, which is funny, you know, when you are writing, when I'm sitting at the desk writing, and quite often I'll put something will make me chuckle in my mind. Then I'll see it on the screen and go, nah, that's just a bully. It was funny in my head.
That's why Hope and Mike Nights exist, basically.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I think on my headset, I like the words. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
I think that's the mantra of almost all comedians everywhere. But I guess we should probably go back to the book a little bit more before we tie off.
Getting back to Catch-22, it's one of those books that I haven't read it in 30 years, 20 years, whatever, 30 years. But it just stays with you. It really, if you, you know, particularly, maybe it was the fact I read it at a formative age. And it was the first big book I ever read. I read the Narnia books, getting back to C.S. Lewis when I was a kid, and Arthur Ransom, The Swallows and Amazons book. But I think it was probably the first book I read as a sort of young boy stroke teenager that was actually written for adults. And as such, it has stayed with me pretty much all my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, as for Joseph Heller, I mean, what a great debut. And it has never been out of print.
That's what you can dream of with any sort of book you bring out.
It's up there with To Kill a Mockingbird from almost the same era. I've always been in print.
It makes sense. So did you have were you the kind of kid where you had a group of people that you'd all read it and you kind of were vibing on it? Or was it just you on your own?
Oh, yeah. No. We had an adolescent book club. What the fuck are you talking about? No.
Okay, I'm just asking questions here.
I'm just sitting around at the recess over our wagon wheels going, so what do you think of the development of Major Major's character? Oh, fuck off.
I guess that's part of because it's funny, now that I'm thinking about it, it's true, like as a reader, you might have one or two mates that kind of sort of touch on the same book sometimes, but mostly you're kind of on your own when you're doing that. That's why, but you said you did in year 12. Yeah. That's why I was thinking maybe there was a bit more.
I did it in year 12. And then my favorite thing of year 12, I was not the most dedicated student. And I decided that, because I was doing advanced English, that I would probably have to read Voss, Patrick White's Voss, and I read it in 48 hours. And then I got in the exam, and the Voss question was so hard, I didn't do it.
That's a good use of 48 hours, I tell you what.
mind you, just apropos of nothing, for some reason I was also doing advanced history, which meant you had to do some primary source stuff. And just out of the blue, I learned Disraeli's Crystal Palace speech on imperialism. I don't know why I decided to learn it by heart. And I sat down at the exam, and there was a question on Disraeli and imperialism. And I went, I know the speech by heart. Okay. I came first in my class in 300 history. There we go.
Really? Like almost verbatim just wrote his speech?
Pretty much. And it was weird. It was like out of all the, it was just sheer dumb luck. I think it was probably the shortest speech. I memorized it. And there was a question virtually on it. And I was like going, Oh yeah. And I got the school prize. I was at uni by the time I announced it, for history. And so being the little socialist wanker I was, I got a book voucher and I bought a copy of Class Struggle, which is a communist version of Monopoly, a board game based on socialism.
What?
Yeah, I was that dickhead.
Okay. Do you still have your social? Firstly, how would a board game based on communism work?
You know what? It's probably in a box somewhere next to the jazz albums I used to buy to impress girls.
Yeah, okay. We're getting a real picture of your early days now.
sad.
It's all starting to come together, actually, right now.
Yeah. Let's like this. Goatee and a beret. I was that guy.
Oh, God.
I was that guy.
See, I love that, one second you're laughing at the concept of a bunch of 15-year-olds sitting around sharing their views on Catch-22. The next second, you're memorizing Benjamin Disraeli's speech from Crystal Palace.
Yeah, I mean, I was an odd kid.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. This doesn't sound like a regular...
I was a really weird kid.
Well, that's again, I think that does go hand in hand with the whole comedy side of things. When you,
you know, there's a small amount of revenge at the heart of every comedian's persona.
So do you reckon you came into your own a bit more like in uni or after uni? Like, was that?
I think I was actually 30 before I was really enjoying life.
Oh, really?
Yeah. One week I was washing dishes and the next week I was doing the breakfast show on Triple J.
Was that? And so, yeah. Were you saying that's about the time when you started feeling a bit more comfortable in yourself? Were you saying that came?
Yeah. Well, you know, it was that thing of like, you know, you always wanted to do something, and then it's like, what? You're going to give me a radio studio and someone to work with, and I'm going to get, and my job is this? What's the downside? I've got to get up early in the morning. Apart from that, nah.
All right. Okay. So you did feel like that almost validation for who you were a little bit by getting.
Look, when I was a teenager, all I ever wanted to do was write skits on the radio and be on Triple J. And I woke up at 30 on my 30th birthday and found out I had the breakfast show on Triple J.
Oh wow. Okay.
And that was, you know what? And 29 years later, that's still pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, I could imagine. That'd be like a really nice, yeah.
It was really cool. You know, I went from the fat guy who couldn't get a date to the year 12 dance to being on the Clio most eligible bachelor's list.
Wow. That took, took a few years, but you managed to, so your 20s was a bit more confused before then.
Yeah, I was a very late bloomer.
Yeah, you might be scientifically a miracle if you're that late.
Well, you know, I'm now reaching an age where if I make it to 61, I'll have outlived both parents and three grandparents.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's...
Wow, we ended up in a really bleak place, didn't we?
But that, it took a bit of a left turn there. Yeah. We went from the joys of youth to the trappings of mortality. Okay, right. That's.
I really did have one too many Negronis last night, didn't I?
That's all right. That's what this... I'm loving the honesty. That's what this is all about. Yeah, because I guess that... So, well, okay. But I guess when you say something like that, do you reckon... It sounds like that's some sad stuff that you've had to deal with early on in life.
Everyone does. Mm. Everyone does. I mean, you know, yeah, I lost both my parents at a young age, which, you know, it was sad at the time, but I'm now seeing my contemporaries, my people my age, dealing with parents in homes who don't, you know, having to put their parents in their homes and dealing with parents who don't recognize their face. So, you know, I'm not saying, you know, I'm glad my parents died when I was young. The point I'm making is that sadness will find you at various stages in your life. That's all.
Mm. Yeah. No, that's, yeah. And there is something to that.
And so, you know, no one has the copyright on being sad.
Yeah. We all get our own flavor of it.
Yeah, everyone gets the shit kicked out of them. Just for me, it happened quite a bit when I was young. And then, you know, it's all been gravy since, baby.
Then you turned 30, got the job on Triple J, and you were done.
And, you know, a few years later, found this incredibly attractive woman, and I'm still married to her. Right.
Well, look, we have jumped around a lot, but I feel we probably should call it there.
Okay, mate, no worries. Lovely to talk to you, George.
No, it's lovely to talk to you. I always ask this at the end of every show. Do you feel like you've felt any new connections with Catch-22 based on what you've thought about in this interview? And
It's just that thing where it sort of – it was actually the process of getting the email, of actually going back over the library of books you've read and going, well, that one. And then, of course, you go, well, that one would be cool. But – and I went – no, actually, Catch-22 was probably, as I said, was the first sort of adult book I read. And that anti-authoritarian, funny yet dark, it's still part of who I am.
Mm. No, that's it. Yeah. And it's one of my favorites as well. So I definitely agree with that choice.
Mm. And, you know, help the bombardier. I'm the bombardier. I'm okay.
Well, okay. We'll call it there. Thank you so much for being on the show, Mikey. It's been an absolute delight.
Too easy, buddy. Take care.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president. You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.